You know, counting the cost is important in any financial endeavor, right? If you go out and buy an automobile, those of us who are older understand there's more to owning an automobile than just whether or not I can make the car payments. You see, owning an automobile also involves making sure that I can pay for the insurance, the fuel, the tires that I'm going to need from time to time, the maintenance on that vehicle. All of those things are part of ownership of an automobile. One of these items, insurance, is apparently something, one thing that many in our country today have found they can't afford. Did you know this year, in this country, 32 million drivers are uninsured? That's an average of 13% of the drivers in this country, across the country. Here in Tennessee, the number is higher. 23.7% of the drivers on the road in Tennessee do not have car insurance. That's almost one in four drivers that you encounter on a daily basis do not have insurance. Counting the cost of owning that vehicle is something that's very important. We understand that from home ownership, don't we? It's not just, can I make the mortgage payments? Can I afford to pay this payment every month on my house so that I can keep my house? There's much more to owning a home than whether or not you can make the mortgage. Can you pay the insurance on that home? Can you pay the property taxes that are going to come due every year on that home? Can you pay for things like utilities and maintenance and home improvements that you may want to make over the years as you continue to live within it? All of those things make up a part of our keeping up with our home and taking care of our home. And so before a young couple buys a home, we need to counsel them, make sure you can make all of the payments that are part of owning that home before you go out and choose, well, I can afford the payments on that car. Can you afford everything else that goes along with owning that car? You see, in our text this morning, and I have to apologize, I apparently gave out the wrong passage. We're actually in Luke chapter 14, verses 24 through 35. That's my fault, but that's where we're going to be spending our time this morning. In that passage, what Jesus does is he speaks to us about our counting the cost before we decide to follow him. Why does he do that? Well, if you go back in Luke to about not even middle ways into his gospel, go back to chapter 9. Jesus makes a statement that lets you know where his mindset is and what he is determined to do. Because as it's recorded for us, when the days were approaching for his ascension, verse 51, he says, Luke records this, he was determined to go to Jerusalem. Well, that phrase, he was determined, if you look in the Old King James, and that passage in the King James hits the nail on the head with translating a certain phrase. It says, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. Have you ever set your face to do something? It means you have a determination to do it. He knew what awaited him in Jerusalem. He knew what was going to happen to him in Jerusalem, and yet he was bound and determined to go there anyway. Why? Because as he says later in this same gospel, he came to give his life as a ransom. Well, actually over in Matthew and Mark, as a ransom for many. He knew he had come to die. A little bit later in this gospel, over in chapter 13, back in verse 22, we read this statement. And he was passing through from one city and village to another, teaching and proceeding on his way to Jerusalem. He didn't say, no, I don't think I want to go that path. I want to do something else. I'm not going to die. No, he was proceeding toward Jerusalem. This is where I must go. This is what I am to do. 11 verses later in that same chapter, Luke chapter 13, down in verse 33, here's what he says. Nevertheless, I must journey on today and tomorrow and the next day, for it cannot be that a prophet would perish outside of Jerusalem. I'm going to die there. I know that. But I am determined to go there anyway. By the time we get to Luke chapter 14 and where we are down in verse 24, we find out that there are scores of people who have attached themselves to Jesus. They're following him. We might today call many of these people hangers-on because they were hanging on to Jesus, waiting to see what's going to be the next miracle he will perform. What's the next encounter he's going to have with the Pharisees? We can't wait to see that. And so, as we see here in our text, what Jesus does is he lays out in unforgettable terms the cost of being a disciple, a follower, a learner of Jesus. He wanted everyone to know what it was going to be like to follow him and to commit themselves to him. He wanted them to understand that to be a disciple was going to cost them dearly. And yet at the same time, he also wanted them to understand that if you are willing to pay this cost, if you are willing to do what is required of you, if you're willing to stay the course, then the benefits of making this decision are going to be worthwhile, more than you can ever imagine. You and I are 2,000 years almost removed from when Jesus spoke these words. And yet what he says to those people in that day are just as important to each one of us here today. Because the question for each of us is, are we counting the cost, what it truly requires of us if we're going to follow Jesus? And we have to ask ourselves, am I willing to pay the cost? Because the thing that Jesus is interested in is commitment, not numbers. He doesn't care a thing about those numbers on that board back there if the hearts of those people, each of us, are not committed to him. That's what he's looking at. That's what he examines in each one of us. Where is your heart today? Are you determined to stay the course, to finish that course, to keep the faith, to fight the good fight of faith? Are you willing to do that? And so what does he do? He talks to them, first of all, about two different costs of discipleship. One is what we might call the relational cost. The other is what we would call the sacrificial cost. The relational cost is what we see in verse 26. And don't miss what he says here. Because he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, and yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Did that get your attention? I'm sure it got the attention of those that were hearing it on that day. I've got to hate my mother, my father. I've got to hate my wife. I've got to hate my husband. I've got to hate my children. You're telling me I have to hate those people if I'm going to follow you? I'm sure they took notice. Is he saying that we literally have to hate those that are closest to us, and even our own selves, if we're going to follow him? Is that literally what he's saying? No. The words he's using here and the way he's doing it is not literal, it's rhetorical. If it's not rhetorical, then you have to look at a whole group of other things that the scriptures teach us. You remember one of the commandments that God handed down to Moses for the Israelites that says, honor your father and mother? That's what God said. It doesn't say anything about hating your father and mother. As a matter of fact, Paul reiterates that. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise that it may be well with you and that you may live long upon the earth. Paul taught that. He didn't say anything about hating your father and your mother. And also, how do we reconcile men, the statement that Paul makes to us over in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, where he says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. He teaches us to love our wives. So does Jesus mean that we have to hate our wives? And how do we deal with what Jesus did himself, his own example, in that he took the children into his arms and he blessed them, as Mark tells us over in Mark 10, verse 16. Or what about the command that he gives in his Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, verse 24, where he teaches us to be reconciled to your brother? Or what about the Sermon on the Plain over in Luke chapter 6? And if you can't keep up with these verses, they're on your handout, so don't worry about that. But in Luke chapter 6, verse 27, where he says there, love your enemies. What did Jesus really teach? He taught us to love your neighbor even as you love yourself, did he not? He said that's the second greatest commandment. He taught his disciples, you love one another even as I have loved you. And he said, by this will all men know that you're my disciples. He didn't say you hate them. He said you love them. So what is Jesus saying when he tells us that we have to hate all of these individuals? It is not a call for us to be insensitive. It is not a call for us to leave all of our feeling for one another behind. It is a call for us to put Jesus first in our lives, to give him the priority in our life. Matthew perhaps brings it out the best of all, because Matthew records Jesus on another occasion as saying this there in chapter 10, down in verse 37. He says there, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. You see, in Jesus' day, a person's decision to follow him came at great cost. It marked that person. You see, if you were living in Jesus' day and you were a Jewish individual and you made the decision, I want to follow Jesus Christ, certain things were about to happen to you. You were going to suddenly be excluded from the synagogue. You could no longer attend synagogue worship where all of your family went. You not only would be excluded from the synagogue, you would be disowned by your family. They would say to you, I don't know you anymore. You're not a part of this family. I remember in my days in graduate school, there was a young man who was a Jew. He was converted to Christianity. His father had told him, if you do that, you are no longer a part of this family. We are disowning you. He made that decision anyway. I knew of another man many years ago who made the decision to become a Christian, and his wife said, get out of the house. I don't want to live with you. And he had to live by himself for a period of time until someone worked as a mediator to bring them back together. You see, this is what Jesus is saying. Are you willing to love me to the point that when your family turns against you, you're still going to stay the course? You're still going to love me? Because in Jesus' day, you would have been ostracized from your community. You would have been an individual without a home, without a family, without a community. And Jesus said, if you're going to follow me, you've got to be willing to accept that. You don't have to read far in the book of Acts before you see that very thing taking place. Those who were becoming Christians were not only experiencing physical persecution, some were dying for their faith. Saul, that would later become the Apostle Paul, was one of the main instigators of that. And yet the same is still true today. There are Muslim countries that if a person chooses to become a Christian, if it becomes known, that person can lose his or her life for their faith. In communist China, there's a crackdown upon those who are claiming to be Christians because of their faith. You and I are privileged right now to live in a place where, for the most part, to be a Christian is still respected. But there are parts of our country where that is beginning to erode, and where that's no longer the case to a great extent. And so the question for each of us to ask ourselves is, do I love Christ so much that I am willing to accept rejection by my own friends and family? Jesus has their attention. You know he does. He goes on to talk now not about the relational cost, but about the sacrificial cost. Because in verse 27, he says, whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. In Jesus' day, the cross was an instrument of execution. Today, we wear it on our jewelry. We put it on our necklaces. We have earrings that have crosses on them. We put crosses on our Bibles, crosses on our shirts, crosses on church buildings in different places. But in Jesus' day, that cross was a symbol of execution. And people understood Jesus bore a cross going to his death. And it would be the Apostle Paul, a number of years later, after he had been preaching the gospel for a good period of time, who would write a letter to the Christians there in Philippi. And if you look over in Philippians chapter 3, and you look at verses 10 and 11, you find out what he says. He had a desire. What's the desire? He said, my desire is to know him. That is Christ. And as he says, the power of his resurrection. And that I might share in the fellowship or in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. And then he says, that by any means possible, I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. So what Jesus is saying is, if you want to follow me, and if you want to be my disciple, you must be willing to bear the pain of persecution. Make that sacrifice. It's something which Jesus said on another occasion in Luke's gospel, there in Luke chapter 9, verses 23 and 24. I'll just share with you verse 23, that it's something we do on a daily basis. He said there, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Every day we do that. As a disciple of Jesus Christ, we must be willing to bear the suffering that will come from attaching ourselves to him. At the Last Supper, following the Last Supper actually, in the upper room, the day before or the evening before he would be crucified, Jesus would say this to his disciples that we find there in John 15. In verse 18, he says, if the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world, the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. Many years later, as an old man, the Apostle John, in writing his first epistle, would remember that, perhaps having even experienced it himself. And he would write these words over in 1 John chapter 3, verse 13. He said, do not be surprised, brethren, if the world hates you. Don't be surprised if one day somebody hates you because you're a Christian. Jesus has got their attention, all right. So now what does he do? He's told about the relational cost and the sacrificial cost of following him. He now tells us, you have to take time to assess the cost. Are you willing to pay it? And he uses two illustrations, two parables. One is of a man building a tower. The other is of a king about to go into battle with his forces. The first one concerning the tower. It's a tower that maybe a homeowner built to guard his vineyard, or a tower that he may have built to plan to build to protect his home. And Jesus' question is this. Which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? You see, he's telling us the wise builder is going to take the time to sit down, figure up the cost, and determine, do I have enough on hand to finish this once I start it? And he knows he's not going to begin that construction until he has the money in hand and he can finish it. Otherwise, he starts and he gets to a certain point and suddenly he finds, I'm out of money. I can't finish this. And as Jesus brings out here, he says, otherwise, when he's laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe him will begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Can you imagine the embarrassment to get so far in something and suddenly you have to walk away from it because you're out of money? And as people drive by, as people walk by, they see it and they say, what happened here? He ran out of money. Really? He didn't sit down and figure out what it was going to cost him to build? He didn't think about all that was involved in that? He just started? Well, yeah. It's rather foolish, don't you think? Have you ever seen a house that was started and not finished? I have. Very nice one, one dime on the way to Franklin, going in the back way through Leaper's Fork. Beautiful home. Started. Owner couldn't finish it. Didn't have the money. Stands there as a monument for everybody that would drive by that house and see it and wonder, who started that? Who began to build but couldn't finish? You see, the same is true of discipleship. What Jesus is saying to those who were following him that day and what he says to us now is that you and I must first sit down and consider whether we're ready to make that personal commitment to follow Jesus and to see it through. If we don't finish our course, if we don't keep the faith, it's not God's fault. We can't blame God. The only person we can blame is ourselves because we didn't first decide, am I willing to make the commitment? Do I have the resolve to stay with it? And will I reflect upon where I'm making mistakes to try to correct those so that I can stay the course? It's us that we have to look at, each one of us. Then there's the second parable. It involves a king going out to battle against another king and his army. And both of these parables, if you look at them, are essentially the same in the basics, but they have some different emphasis. The first involves an individual going to build a tower. He can choose to build the tower. He can choose not to build the tower. Even if he has the money, he still has the freedom to say, I'm not going to build the tower. I don't want to build the tower. The king is in a different predicament. He has someone coming against him. He doesn't have the option to say, I don't want to deal with this today. I don't want to respond to this. He's got to do something. The question is, what will he do? He has half as many troops as the one coming against him, as Jesus says. King going out to meet another in battle, first sit down and consider whether he's strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter one coming against him with 20,000. So he has to sit down and he will first consider whether he is strong enough with his smaller army to actually be victorious over this other king with his larger army. And he says that if he decides he's not, he will first sit down or he will send and ask for terms of peace. He won't go to engage him in battle. Because to have launched into battle without first giving it careful consideration of what was going to be required in terms of men and armament would have been disastrous, both to him and to his men and to his kingdom. What is Jesus saying? Before we choose to follow Jesus, we need to first sit down and ask ourselves, is this something I'm willing to do and will stay with? Do you realize that almost every accomplishment in life requires a cost? It's going to require a cost. Some of you have raised children or grandchildren. They played sports. Maybe they played an instrument in the band. Maybe they haven't expressed a desire to go on and to become a better player. I want to play at the college level. I want to play at the professional level. I want to play in the high school band. I want to play eventually in an orchestra somewhere, a symphony. Did you sit down and talk to them and say, are you willing to count the cost? How much time are you willing to put into practice? Because if you want to become that good, you're going to have to put a lot of time into practice. And it also means that you're going to have to put some other things off to the side. You're going to have to forego some things. There are going to be some events you're not going to be able to participate in. Some things you're not going to be able to do because while your friends are doing that, you're going to be practicing. Are you willing to pay that price? Just a few years ago, there was a man by the name of Malcolm Gladwell. He wrote a book called The Tipping Point. In that book, he talks about what he calls the 10,000 hour rule. I'd never heard it before until I read it. I thought, this is quite interesting. What is the 10,000 hour rule? It's something he found to be one of the tipping points. What he found is that people who are experts in their field, who have made it to the professional level in whatever arena they may be, have on average, or actually have had to put in a minimum of 10,000 hours of practice, of study, of learning, of developing their skill. 10,000 hours. Think about that with your teenager. 10,000 hours. If you want to become a professional, 10,000 hours. How much time are you going to spend in practice to reach that level? And he says it has to be the right kind of practice, not the wrong thing where you're being taught the wrong principles or wrong techniques, but it has to be the right thing. Folks, we do that in everything we do, do we not? How many people you know that are electricians or plumbers or welders or mechanics or involved in HVAC or something else like that that had to first count the cost? Because you may have gotten your certificate, you may have gone to the trade school and been educated and learned what you had to do, but let me ask you this, is there a need to keep current on the latest technology, on the changing codes, and on the various procedures that are being brought out about how to do this now as opposed to how it was done 20, 30, 40 years ago? Yes, it's changing every day. What about if you want to become an accountant, a lawyer, a doctor, a pilot? I think most of us in this room understand it doesn't end with the degree. It doesn't end when you're able to put the diploma on the wall. There's a thing called continuing education. You have to keep up with the changing laws. You have to keep up with the changing aspects of the planes that you're flying or whatever it is, whatever field you're in. It's always changing. Doctors are constantly reading up on the latest studies that have come out, the findings on certain diseases or certain illnesses in order to treat a patient. They've had to count the cost. And the question for each of us comes down, what am I willing to commit to in following Jesus? What sacrifices am I willing to make if I'm going to be one of His? And Jesus even says, you need to consider your possessions. I mean, He's holding nothing back, folks. He wants those who are following Him to know, if you're really going to follow Me, this is what you need to consider. And as He puts it in verse 33, so then none of you can be My disciple who does not give up all his possessions. Oh, that's another one of those hard statements. Remember the rich young ruler that came to him and he said, first go and sell all that you have, give to the poor, then come follow Me. You'll have a home in heaven. And he went away, what? Sorrowful, because he had many possessions. Is Jesus telling us here this morning, you've got to first go out and sell everything you own. Get rid of your house, get rid of your automobiles, get rid of your portfolio, give it all. And then come follow Me. Because you can't be My disciple if you're not willing to give that up. No, that's another one of those rhetorical areas. You see, what he's saying is that we've got to distance ourselves from our materialistic attachment. If those things are more important to us than following Him, he says, you're not ready to be My disciple. You may think you are, but you're not. Do you know anybody that spends more time maintaining their hobby, investing money in their hobby, participating in the hobby than they do in studying God's Word, in being a part of worship with brothers and sisters in Christ? Is there someone that's not here this morning because they're somewhere else doing something that they want, love more, hunting, fishing, you name it, because that's really where their love is? Jesus is calling us to stop and count the cost. It's not how little we give, but it's how much God deserves that is the real question. Look at how he ends. He says, therefore salt is good. But if even salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? It is useless either for the soil or for the manure pile, it is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. You and I are familiar with using salt as a seasoning, as a preservative. Maybe some of you used salt this morning. You put it on something you were going to eat before you left home. Maybe it was those eggs, if you had eggs this morning, or whatever it may have been. You may have seen salt used as a preservative. Those hams that have been hanging out in a smokehouse somewhere that have been rubbed in salt, preserving that. You may have had some of that this morning with your breakfast. You understand that. But what about, it's not even good for the manure pile. I'll be honest with you, until I prepared for this lesson, I thought he was just talking about just throwing it away. But that's not at all what he's talking about. You see, Jesus was pointing to a practice that was used in his day. And in certain countries, it's still used today. And that is that they would take salt and they would add it to the manure pile because it had a way of enhancing the manure in the fertilization of their crops. You see, not only would it mask the smell of the manure, but that salt would make the manure more beneficial for whatever was being planted. It could actually increase crop production because they were adding salt in with it. And yet what Jesus is saying is that if salt loses its special characteristics, it's no longer even good for that. It's no longer beneficial. It won't even do any good in helping the manure pile. What's he saying to us? Folks, he's saying something very simple. If you obey the gospel, if you commit your life to living for me, and then somewhere along the line, you lose that commitment or you don't follow through with your commitment, you lose your distinctiveness as one of my disciples, he's saying, you're not of a benefit to anyone. You can't help anyone at that point. The question for all of us here this morning, maybe a couple of questions. Am I still devoted to the Lord? Am I still devoted to Him? Have I taken the time to count the cost? Am I paying that cost? Because He wants you to follow Him. He calls you. Come unto me, all you who are laboring or heavy laden. I will give you rest. He wants you to be His disciple. He wants you to be a part of His kingdom. But He's not going to hide it and tell you, it's going to be easy. You won't have any difficulty. You can do it in your sleep. No. He wants you to know it's going to cost. It's going to require something of you. The question is, are you willing to give it? Are you willing to give it every day of your life for the rest of your life until the day He finally calls you home? I pray that you are. If you need this morning, though, to rededicate your life because you know I've been doing everything else but being committed to Him. I've worn that name Christian for a number of years, but I haven't really lived it out in my life. Change that today. Recommit. Let Him know I want to be yours. And if you're a person here today that you've not yet made the commitment, sit down and count the cost. Don't just jump up and say, I want to become a Christian. Count the cost. Ask Him to help you be faithful in following Him all the days of your life. And if you're ready today to obey the gospel, to turn away from the sin that's in your life, to truly follow Him and to confess Him as your Lord and your Savior, and to be buried with Him in baptism, if you're ready to do that today, then we invite you to come right now as together we stand and sing.